This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
In that slim interface between the most public of realms and those most private of desires in Vito Acconci's work, architecture has been ever-present, as friendly cohort, as quintessential instrument of his artistic practice. Now, in this partnership of disciplines, most recently, Acconci seems to have shrugged off art altogether, nonchalantly alleging that he is now altogether an architect and no longer at all an artist. Now, Acconci's claim centers on the trajectory of his work and nature of his practice. As his art evolved from poetry in the earliest part of his career to performance and then to installation, becoming larger and increasingly functional, it gradually and then wholly embraced terrains properly acknowledged as architecture, or at least landscape architecture. Acconci quotes his friend Richard Serra, "Once sculpture is useful, it is architecture." In one knowingly foul swoop, Acconci's statement dismisses architecture's long and most often unrequited quest to become art, while at the same moment confining art to the narrowness of personal expression. His long-standing desire to, quote, redo architecture has been replaced by a seemingly practical realization on the structure and organization of the two different practices. Quote, "I started being convinced that to be public, things have to start out as public. I don't want to do things by myself. There needs to be at least three people involved for an argument to evolve. That is when the work starts to become public." That's interesting. He said that to me in a telephone conversation in almost the exact same words that he said in the lecture last night. Now, indeed, in Acconci's studio, he now employs six architects and only two artists, the latter of whom are relegated to working as office manager and general archivist. It's true. And yet it remains contentious, at least for me, that Acconci truly believes what he is saying. Does he really want architects to believe that he is one of them, now that he has to reside within the realms of bids and contracts and insurance liabilities? Does he think that artists and critics will concede easily that he has abandoned his long-established thematic pursuits now that his production is inscribed within a different media of practice? Or here my suspicions are most jaded, is he instead attempting a sleight of hand aimed at convincing sponsors of increasingly large commissions that he is now a professional builder rather than an artist canonized long ago as subversive? I will not attempt to codify Acconci's practice in professional categories because in his work, the duality of the two practices open extremely interesting questions. Interrogating and reinterrogating questions of the body, this duality confronts terrains of intimacy and publicity in binary reversals flipping between interiority and exteriority. Between the two vantages offered by the two disciplines, I hope to offer differences between the capacity of the installation and or the architectural work to provoke, reinforce, and coordinate behavior through the bodies of its author, its viewers, and its inhabitants. Indeed, Acconci worries himself in his new role about architecture's power to impose and or constrain action of the participating public. But as I will try to show, Acconci himself, over the course of his career, has deployed these very practices to the extent of making architecture's same propensity pale in comparison. In the course of cycles of somewhat deconstructive probes, architecture itself has been disempowered. And this will be the last time today you see Seedbed. Now, after poetry and his street works, when Acconci enters the gallery proper, he explodes spectacularly into the art world with Seedbed, a piece whose seamy audacity has haunted his reputation ever since. In Seedbed, the architecture of the floor, the setting of the everyday, is only slightly altered, but significantly so. A tilt deconstructs the everyday perception of the floor, reinforced explosively as a visitor realizes the ongoing pleasures underneath. Acconci says of his work, "I wanted to become the architecture of the room." It's very important. Now, indeed, a conscious body undermines the very ontology of the room. The explicit ordinariness of the room, its essential conventionality, is put into an exquisite tension with the event taking place within the silence of the section of the floor, a space appropriated from architecture, long sanctified as a silent realm of construction. Now, certainly, the floor itself is functional. It allows, after all, visitors to walk above Akanchi's body, placing them directly in the context of the most private of acts while still in public space. The function of the floor, then, is twofold. It completes the conventionality of the room and gives the room its autonomy, but an autonomy that is destroyed simultaneously. Akanchi's clever technique operates as a perfect binary spiral. The room proper emerges as it dissolves. Ontology is reified and destroyed at the same moment. Stuffed into architecture, the body tenaciously reinstates its primacy. The architecture quintessentially necessary for the piece is ultimately subsumed. Now, immediately following Seedbed, Akanchi embarks on a series of installation performances that began as architectural sketches, three-dimensional axonometric projections of simple plans. To architects, these are primitive, scratchy drawings with only a rudimentary sense of dimension and space. There is no craft to these drawings. There is no intent to have these qualify as the products of the artist, of course, the presumption of the architect. No attention either is given to the state or quality of the room. To function properly in Akanchi's performance, the rooms are required to be completely anonymous, conventional spaces. And indeed, the drawings are more similar to maps, but not to places, to events. They inscribe actions and elements, as well as walls and passages. They are instructional, akin to theatrical blocking diagrams. Now, at the end of a long bisected room in props, and this is from a gallery in Belgium in 1973, is a storefront where Akanchi's face is pressed into the glass facing the street. He regularly turns his body to face the narrow corridor within. The viewer who decides to enter the gallery is given a choice by Akanchi on audio tape. Quote, "If you, the viewer, don't come up behind me, if you don't do something behind my back, then I'd know I can trust you. But then you'd be ignoring me. But if you attack me, then you'd want me to be here only so that you could get rid of me. But if you caressed me instead, you'd be turning me into an object. Since I wouldn't respond, you'd be treating me as if I weren't here." While his body is present, it is mute, stripped of its potential to express. It is the room, in fact, that replaces Akanchi's psyche. As in Seedbed, the room is put forward as a space of Akanchi's consciousness, here strategically paranoid. The room is the precise instrument with which he engenders a particularly painful pas de deux as the viewers decide whether or not to transgress Akanchi's bodily and psychological space. There is no room. There is no architecture. This is, again, only Akanchi reframing himself. Just a few years later, the next phase of Akanchi's work leaves behind the hapless anonymity of the room. And this is Leveling, also in Sonnabend, but in 75. Evolving into far more elaborate settings overlaid with video projections and audio voiceovers, Akanchi awakens to the possibility of choreographing precise relationship between constituent elements of architectural space. However far more vastly sophisticated in architectural terms, we nevertheless see the same instrumentalization of architecture as it is put to the surface of service of manifesting Akanchi's psyche intersecting the viewers. Here, the three kinds of spaces compress and expand, contain and guide and intersect the bodies of visitors as an Akanchi audio tape plays themes of loss and memory and videos project Akanchi's disembodied head and hands, all familiar techniques and themes by now. Now, we also see, however, Akanchi's affinity for architecture itself. The spatiality of suspended linear objects cutting three-dimensionally through space recalls all sorts of architectural devices. From the legacy of vast shifting horizons of landscape of Le Nôtre, or the spatial infinities of planar elements of Mies van der Rohe, perhaps, or even the more recent violin cuts of Liebeskind. But here these techniques are appropriated from architecture, which does not typically act to obstruct or violate bodily space. In Round Trip, A Space to Fall Back On, shown at the Whitney in December 1975, as Akanchi speaks on audio tape, three spotlights operate between pieces of furniture mounted on a wall. There is a continuous voiceover which seems to emanate from the walls and furniture themselves. So again, the room is personified, this time in quite literal terms. The room is speaking to the audience, as if the elements taken from conventional settings of architecture, floors, walls, and furniture, are given theatrical character. Now, the reference is explicitly architectural, but the mobilization, of course, belongs to art, a disciplinary question which is even more confounded when we realize that this show stands as a significant precedent to the Artists Cum Artists, Diller and Scofidio's 1989 Parasite installation at MoMA. Now, within the same trajectory of issues, next comes Akanchi's deployable pieces. In these, we see the same preoccupation with using highly loaded associative fragments, typically a domestic object or piece of furniture, which is disassembled and then reassembled in states of unfamiliar familiarity. With its calling forth of home through personal artifact, architecture's elements give Akanchi a palette of psychological media. In these highly theatrical pieces, however, Akanchi's touch is notably lighter. We see the fun house, not the uncanny house. The dark psychological traces of the present and absent body, particularly Akanchi's body, have evolved into body jokes, tricks, and shared laughs with viewers and visitors. Akanchi begins also to share architecture's obsession with kineticism and deployability. In these pieces, Akanchi is even more tied to the craft of assemblage, to the nuances proposed by the manifestation of the pieces in finely tuned material terms. In Community House, which you see here, a long house, identified, of course, overtly by the gable, is completely closed until opened by rope mechanisms attached to bicycles in the gallery. Without the cooperation of another visitor, one cannot enter the house. Hypothetically, if the cyclist stops pedaling while someone is inside, the person is trapped until released by the next cyclist. The engagement of one body in the desired space is thus codependent on the body of another in action. Visitors' bodies become complicit with each other, and Akanchi, as artist, choreographs these new relationships with a humorous but nonetheless absolute authority. In Multibed, the installation is now composed entirely of manipulations to furniture that belong to the body and its most private acts. Assembled to recall constructivist sculpture, the final configuration is not realized until the actions of the visitor's body put into effect turning mechanisms that toss the bodies together, forcing a wanted or unwanted public intimacy, casting other visitors in the gallery as instant voyeurs. Again, Akanchi has left off instilling himself as psyche, as personal body, as the final culmination of these pieces. But although lighthearted, these pieces can also be seen as rather coercive moments of engagement, where Akanchi demands that visitors let go of their inhibitions and interact. Now, after such a career, Akanchi asks us to believe that when he turns his intentions to the completely public realm and the design of installations at the scale of public space and landscape, that it is architecture that what we must be afraid of in terms of forcing visitors' bodies into complicated relationships. And this is then the disciplinary dilemma which arises. In a gallery, the manipulation of visitors' bodies and consciousness are acceptable as constituent to the intention of the art piece. Can we identify this as the emergence of a terrain of practice particular to art, where the extreme manipulation of the viewer in the cause of provoking a tense consciousness of herself, her constraints, her relationship with others is permitted? In architecture or landscape architecture, transference of the same manipulation is not, as this is revalued as extremely coercive when it occurs in generic public space, mythologized as democratic. But in the design of landscape and public space, at what point does any form of articulation become coercive? Now, Akanchi certainly gives us, more than enough evidence that the thematic material developed over a lifetime continues directly into his public space pieces. Quote, "Landscape is an object for the body. As landscape is molded, pushed under, and pulled out of itself, it acts as a response to the body's assertion into the landscape. Conversely, he says, quote, parallel planes are driven through the body. And certainly this is the same interest that we saw developing as early as the 70s in the installation that I showed at Sonnabend. Now, in this new turn to landscape, there is a preoccupation with the spiral as a formal mechanism which allows moving in and out of the plane of the ground, concurrently being inside and outside a form. Akanchi is as possessed with the idea of bodies under and over the landscape or constructed surfaces as he was originally in Seedbed. The ground here is as furtive a media as the personal act of masturbation. It is alive and active underneath. His metaphor for this preconscious animation of the ground is the landmine. Now, in many of these projects, the ground for Akanchi is also abundant with liquid. He notes that the essential operation when dealing with landscape is to dig. And when one digs, one inevitably finds water. His landscapes are thus dominated by pools and waterfalls, walls of water, wetlands, and swamps. In his more environmental, utopian pieces, the land is acknowledged as a repository for trash. From landfills where trash is seen as the waste of society, the waste of the body, waste is pulled back into the conscious landscape. It becomes a new place to reside within. The viscerality of all of these gestures suggests that after decades or so of toying with room and furniture-sized containers for the body, has Akanchi now finally rescaled his body into the landscape itself? The organic formal gestures of Akanchi's most recent work should be familiar to any observer of the current architectural moment. Indeed, Akanchi says he regards it absolutely necessary to make with the tools of the moment, as it is to listen to the music of the moment, to reside within the edge of developing currents and technologies in order to make that which could previously not be made. It is noteworthy, however, to make distinctions with those simultaneously unfolding in the sphere of contemporary architectural production. In his evolution to the biomorphism afforded by advanced three-dimensional software, Akanchi clearly follows the pack and does not lead such figures as Greg Lynn, Foreign Office Architects, Knox, and here, Reiser Yamamoto. Indeed, as his scratchy architectural drawings of the 70s were all but naive as architectural configurations, so are his latest efforts at the biomorphic. I have to say that for all the architecture students in the room. Now, for those many of you who are not involved with this current realm, this new architecture is dedicated to generative methods which hypothetically distance the authority of the architect. Work which blatantly is authored is most often derided as, quote, compositional. That's the great accusation in reviews these days. Now, in a dizzying search for objective generators, from abstract data fields to iterative animation techniques, or software borrowed from distant scientific procedures, highly intricate and complex formal gestures have emerged. To this realm of architecture, frankly, Akanchi's latest venture seems stylistically naive, a consequence of engaging the field without sufficient training in its tools and methods. Yesterday in the lecture, I sat next to my graduate thesis student, who often teaches me rather than the other way around, and he grounded my suspicions. Akanchi's generation of surfaces is too often the result of the most basic tools that the most basic software has to offer. Rather than the exhaustive search in architecture for modes of expression buried within the generative capacity of the computer, Akanchi's use represents the first cycle of formal generation. So no matter how many people work on a piece in his office, there is very much in his methodology a direct presence of the author. Now, Akanchi's practice as artist, however, puts this initial reading into proper perspective. In Island on the Muir, built in Graz, 2001, it's like the greatest hits of Akanchi again, Akanchi builds a theater of public activity into the river in the middle of the city, another spiral, a yin-yang of interior-exterior space, surface within water or above it, with water itself pumped up and flowing around the curved shells of the exterior. Visitors come in through a bridge and are faced with choices, to stay above the form in an outdoor amphitheater and or a playground, a series of outside cusps, or to go into the interior of the form, into a bar and other functional spaces. Children are given the opportunity to play on its surfaces, equipped with bars to hang on to the vertiginous fields. Can this piece be seen as anything more obvious than an organ lifting out of the body of the landscape? But as in Akanchi's earlier work, the presence of the bodies of the visitors themselves complicate this immediate metaphor. At all moments of Akanchi's spiral, these bodies can be observed through transparent surfaces, occupying and interacting with different realms above and below and with each other. Here, there are no empty, gratuitous formal gestures. Each form and surface becomes fully configured as it is interacted with, activated by a redundancy of functions, as well as modes of perceiving visitors as they act upon the form. Rather than similar organic formalisms of architects of the moment, Akanchi's piece acts like his room installations and his deployable structures as ultimately reducible by the actions of the interacting bodies involved. They cannot be read as naive forms. They are instead well entrenched still within the narrative of Akanchi's art installations and its spatial and collaborative practices. As Seedbed did in 1972, Akanchi's latest work acts through the architectural object, but at the same time relies finally on obliterating fixed ontologies through the actions and events provoked and contained. As always, Akanchi's pieces exist fundamentally as interfaces, interstitial moments between visitors, configured blatantly to bring disparate bodies together and provoke a consciousness of their own interactions. In this, Akanchi is as assertive an author as he ever was, and cannot use the guise of architecture to fear designing behavior. Architecture has always been more or less guilty, for better or worse, to varying degrees of this authoritative trait. It is, however, Akanchi's continued mantle and authority as artist that gives these latest pieces their resonant specificity, as acts of art built in the media of architecture. Thank you.